I spent most of the night walking the floor, feeling the .44 pressed against my back. Every now and then, I would take my left arm out of the sling and move it around as much as possible. I needed to get whole and be ready for tomorrow. No matter how I tried to concentrate on my plans, I kept seeing my genie holding that tiny, silent baby. I prayed that somehow, someday, she would forgive me. I knew I would never forgive myself. Were it not for the crazy, twisted mess I would leave behind, I would have raised that pistol to my head that night. More than once I considered it, but hell, that was just making it easy on myself. I would just pile more hurt on Jeannie. God knows she'd had enough. Besides, if there was one thing I was determined to do in life, it was to kill Zanone. Killing Zanone had been my sworn intention since the day old Cletus rode them licking flames. It seemed the longer I let my promise of vengeance go unattended, the more suffering was heaped upon innocent people. I had to get out of here. I had to see my genie one last time, and I had to kill Zanone. I could put it off no longer. If the sheriff tried to stop me, I reckoned I would kill him, but not for Mather's sake. I would kill him only if he stood between me and freedom. Otherwise, I would knock him in the head and apologize to Mather if I ever saw him again. For all of Mather's far-handed scheming, he had saved my life. I had to give him that. The next morning, when Sheriff Scheckler stood outside my cell, it was all I could do to keep from killing him on the spot.
Come over here, boy. Let's take a look at you.
He was a fat, greasy walrus, with deep pits of blackheads formed under swollen, bloodshot eyes. I stepped over by the bars, and he backed off a step, looking me up and down. He smelled like sour lard and mildew.
So you're the scum that caused that Wilcox whore to splatter her bastard kid all over the carpet.
It took such restraint on my part from killing him right there that I shook like a man with palsy. But I held on, tasting a bitter bile that cramped my jaws and set fire in the back of my throat. I stared at him and tried to control my breathing. I decided to say nothing. I knew that my own words would send me into a bloodletting rage.
I've watched that little filly for a long time. I've always said, I bet that's the sweetest patch of fur a man could ever sink a shank in.
He stepped close to the bars, twisting his holster close. I saw the safety strap was unbuckled and realized he was trying to goad me into reaching for his pistol. I wasn't going to fall for it.
Yes, sir. Oh, I can just feel her legs wrapped around me, wiping the sweat off my ass.
I felt a deathly calm sweep over me. Now that I saw what he was up to, I just let it slide past me. He stepped back in surprise and disappointment. He hooked the safety strap on his holster.
Oh, I reckon you're just a cowardly piece of trash. We're all better off without your little bastard stinking up the town. If I'd been there, I would have mashed its head and threw it in the hog lot.
He blew a wad of spit in my face, but I just stood there and let it run down. When he started for the door, I stared after him, almost wanting to thank him. He had just made everything so clear in my mind. It would be no problem killing him. Hell, I would have paid Mather for such an honor. Scheckler didn't know it, but he had just uncomplicated my life. He became a dead man the second he opened his ugly mouth. That afternoon, in spite of all the torment pressing my mind, I forced myself to sleep. Waking with the last rays of sun stretched in broad stripes across the stone floor, I wiped my sweaty face on the wool blanket and got ready for a busy night. Mather showed up with a tin plate of grits and gravy. He shoved it under the cell door and smiled as I picked it up and faced him.
What do you think of our friend, the sheriff?
I drew my finger across my throat.
Yeah, I figured you two would hit it off.
He reached a hand through the bars and dropped a key in my shirt pocket.
That key has his initial stamped on it. I switched it with him this morning. In case he tried to get in there and punch around on you a little, I filed the other one off just enough so it wouldn't work for him. So I reckon you've been safer in there than he's been out here.
Dave, you're a piece of work.
One more thing. I'm surprised you didn't ask, but Scheckler's the one who told Zanone and Wilcox you were headed this way. He spotted you over in Springfield 2 days before you got here and wired the information. That's how I got word of it. I had no way to warn you, but I figured if I was there, I could tip your odds a little.
Don't worry, Dave. His ass will suck maggots before this night's over.
You watch your back, Mr. Crow, or whoever the hell you are.
Scheckler must have thought the gates of hell had swung open on him. Laying back in his chair with his feet propped on the desk, I sat patiently for a while on the edge of the desk waiting for him to wake up on his own. I didn't want to startle him and cause him to miss a thing. In what little time he had left, I wanted his full attention. As Scheckler began to wake up, he dropped his hand down to his crotch to scratch himself. His fingers tapped against the shotgun barrel, and a confused look came over his face.
What?
Then, as realization came upon him like a cold hand, his face lost all color. He looked into my eyes. His jaw muscles went slack.
My God.
Tell me about your dream, Sheriff. Was you dreaming about my wife? Let's see, how was it you said it? Her legs wrapped around your sweaty ass. I bet your old ass is sweating, sure enough, ain't it? Knowing I'm gonna blast your balls off.
Please, God. Don't do it. Don't do it.
Oh, come on, Sheriff. Be a sport about it. You said all that stuff about my wife and my little dead baby. You know I've got to carve you up a little.
I had my wounded left arm in the sling holding the shotgun. With my right hand, I slashed the Glades knife twice across his stomach, making a perfect X. I pressed the dull edge of the blade across his throat while he tried to hold his guts in.
Get to hell, Scheckler. Try to say something nice about the devil's wife.
I popped one round from the shotgun in his crotch. The explosion slammed him down through the shattered chair in a spray of blood and burnt powder. Then I stabbed the Glades knife down in the center of the desk. Underneath it, I'd left a note for Zanone. It said, "Sleep on this till I come to wake you." Across the bottom, I signed it with just two initials, M.C. After slipping my mare from the stable, I tore out to the sanitarium where they'd taken Janine. When I got there, I pointed my .44 at a young doctor.
"You're taking me to Janine."
I snatched the doctor by the collar and burrowed my .44 into his ear. Walking stiff-necked and on the sides of his shoe soles, he led me to Janine's room straight away. Dropping the gun beside her on the bed, I took her by the shoulders and leaned my face close to hers in the dim glow of the lamp.
"Janie? Janie, it's me. Can you hear me?"
She stirred, barely opening her eyes. She looked pale and weak.
"Jess, you made it. Here, you came all the way just to see me."
I snatched up the gun and pointed it straight in the doctor's face.
"What the hell have you done to her?"
"Nothing, I swear. We've only tried to comfort her. She's been through an awful lot."
I turned from him and drew her up against me.
"Janine. Janie, baby. God, I'm so sorry."
Don't be sorry. You can't be here, Jess. They'll kill you."
"I can't leave you this way."
"We've sure had a time of it. You, me, and the baby."
She seemed to drift away. I looked around at the doctor, and he gave me a sad look and a shake of his head.
"She doesn't even know if you're really here. Now, please, we've got to let her rest."
Easing her back gently to the pillow, I felt her hand try to hold onto my sleeve and slip softly away. I'd come to see her one last time to tell her I was sorry, to tell her I loved her, that I would always love her. I wanted to tell her I'd come back for her someday. But standing there, seeing the pain I had caused her, I reckon it was better to end it this way. I was leaving her marked as a murderer's wife. There was nothing I could do or say to lessen the shame I'd brought her. I rode hard for 3 days through storms that pounded out from across the Rockies, leaving the land sodden and the sky low and dismal. The morning I arrived at the widow's cabin, the sun had managed to squeeze through and its glitter spread across the wet woodlands. The sunlight at the end of those dark storms reminded me that no matter what had just happened, it was time to pick up the pieces and try to go about the business of staying alive.
"It's that no-good saddle tramp friend of yours."
In a second, Jack was out on the porch while I got down from the saddle. His eyes were glassy, and he looked like a man suffering a bad head cold. Behind him, the shredded-eared hound lay under the porch.
Be damned. Can't you go nowhere without getting shot?
It ain't as bad as it looks. And it's the least of my worries right now.
What's wrong?
I'm in trouble. Big trouble, Jack. It's the kind of trouble you might not want to be any part of. I killed a lawman.
Come on inside. We'll talk about this more.
Inside the cabin, I dropped into a wooden chair and flipped back a corner of my poncho.
I hope you ain't expecting me to clean that mess.
Shut your damn mouth. My friend is hurt. Now get your broad ass busy to boil some water or get me a knife. Or damn it, do something.
No knife, Jack. It's a clean flesh wound.
I don't mind cutting in there. I'll scrape the bone if need be.
I know, but thanks.
Now, what about this trouble you're in?
I stared at him a second, thinking maybe he missed what I'd said coming through the door.
Jack, I killed a lawman. I gutted him like a hog and left him wallowing on the floor.
Jack gazed at me through his glassy eyes as if waiting to hear more.
That's it. That's a big trouble I'm in.
Oh, well, hell. I thought you meant something really bad.
Jack, I killed a lawman, hear me? A lawman!
So?
So they'll hunt me down and hang me.
I've known you for 2 years, and so far I ain't seen you do anything they won't hang you for.
3 weeks later, we joined Jesse and Frank at the Samuel place. Between fights, the widow had done a right good job of nursing my shoulder wound. Though she was crazier than a three-eyed squirrel, I could see that she and Jack didn't make too bad a couple. I told Jesse and Frank about Kansas City, about me killing Sheckler, and about Zanone and possibly many others, thinking Jesse and I were the same person. Except for a few details, they'd already heard the whole story. Since my killing Sheckler, Clell Miller had made contact with mysterious Dave Mather. Dave told him everything. From now on, he would be handling any bank money we couldn't spend right away. I was glad to hear it. Mather was a good man to have on our side. He'd done a lot for me. For a high price, of course. I'd also told them about me robbing the banker near the widow's place and how Jesse might get the blame for it. They got a big kick out of it. As it turned out, Jesse started circulating a story about some poor, helpless widow who was being evicted from her land and how he, in an act of kindness, saved the day. Somehow, Jesse wound up looking like a hero for robbing the heartless son of a bitch. I reckon any story is only as good as the man who's telling it. I never mentioned Janine. They knew what had happened, but they respected me enough to leave my private life alone. As far as how I felt about it, I reckon they didn't have to ask. It must have showed on my face. By the end of that year, we had hit two banks and a railroad. I tell you, with all I was going through, it felt good to stay busy. Two or three times during the year, I caught myself ready to ride out and find Zanone. But outside my circle, away from the protection of my friends, I was hotter than a two-peckered billy goat. Then, as always, lawmen avenged their own. The name Miller Crow must have been whispered like a silent prayer every morning when they shoved their .44s down into their holsters. It didn't matter that Sheckler was a snake. They wanted me dead. Dave Mather finally convinced some of the Missouri lawmen that Jesse and I were not the same person. It helped Jesse. Most local lawmen didn't care how much northern money Jesse stole, but if he had killed one of their peers, that was a whole other matter. It didn't change my situation at all. At any rate, though, I knew I couldn't get at Zanone anytime soon. I prayed for the day. And if there was a God in heaven, I knew it would come when I could reach inside his open skull and dabble my fingers in his dying brains. Over the next 10 years, Jesse and I worked out a plan. I would pull a job with some of the boys while he was somewhere with witnesses 200 miles away. It was good thinking. If ever Jesse was caught, it would take the court forever to sort out what he did or didn't do. Not only that, it kept the law and the railroad agents from knowing where to expect us next. So, during those years, while the law ran in circles like a hound chasing its tail, Jesse, Frank, and the rest of us went about marrying, robbing, raising youngins, and tending to our lives as did everybody else. While I seldom ventured away on my own, there was one summer when Jack and I took a string of horses all the way out to Powder River. It was the nearest the law ever came to capturing Miller Crow, but that's a whole other thing. It had been Jack's notion that we could sell horses to the army and hit a couple of banks on the way back. But the whole idea was a disaster. We had it out with Indians, bounty hunters, outlaws, local lawmen, and the U.S. Army. I could have killed Jack, but it taught me one thing. I learned to stay close to my own people. Our first civilian train robbery was Frank's and my idea. I heard Reno's bunch was doing really well robbing trains. I figured if those dumb bastards could do it, we had to give it a try. I'd taken such a hootin' from everybody over the Powder River mess, I needed to come up with a good idea just to save face. Robbing that train had been like opening up a sack full of rattlesnakes. Railroads had all the money in the world and were old hands at forcing and enforcing their will. Where banks had a hard time figuring out just how to deal with our new enterprise, the railroads and express companies jumped on us like a duck on a June bug. Banks were always careful of their image and kept a close eye on public opinion. Railroads? Hell. To them, we were no different than the buffalo. They'd get us off their tracks in one bloody heap, image be damned. We were costing them money. Money that could buy back public opinion once the cold sod hit our faces. Since law enforcement hadn't sorted out who was who in the robbing circle, the Reno gang got the blame because they dealt heavy in train robbery, even though I identified myself as Jesse James that day on the train and looked dead like him. When Jesse heard Reno got credit for our first train robbery, he blew up. I couldn't believe he acted the way he did. It was like a child pouting over who'd won a foot race. I went straight to Frank.
What's eating at Jesse? I figured he'd be tickled to death we didn't get the call for that train job. Instead, he's acting all riled up about it.
Frank shrugged, but I saw a concerned look in his eyes. Then he glanced around the yard and jerked an envelope from inside his pocket.
This is a letter Jesse wrote to the newspaper in Springfield. He's actually griping about Reno's bunch getting credit for the train job. Can you believe this? Come here.
Frank nodded toward the barn.
I want to show you something else.
Inside the barn, he flipped up the lid of a large wooden feed bin. When the lid flipped back, I saw the pile of blue medicine bottles.
Damn. Are these Jesse's?
Every damn one. That's how much morphine laudanum he's gone through in the past 7 months.
There must be over 100 empty bottles here.
117. Now, I don't know what the hell to do. I know he's having a lot of trouble with that old chest wound, but I fear he's going out of his head on this stuff. And Jack Smith ain't helping matters a bit.
You saying Jack is causing Jesse to drink that stuff?
I ain't sure what I'm saying. But every time Jack leaves here for 2 or 3 days, he comes back rattling like a peddler's wagon.
Jack's as good a friend as I've ever had.
I know. That's why he's still alive. Cole's been wanting to kill him for the longest time, but I've refused him.
What's Cole got against him?
Who knows? Probably just the fact that Jack's fast with a gun. You know Cole.
Yeah, and I'll know him in past tense if he tangles with Quiet Jack. I promise you, Jack will chop him off at the ankles.
Either way, we got to do something about Jack, and we got to do something about Jesse.
Leaving the barn, we walked past the porch and saw the two of them, Jesse and Quiet Jack Smith, leaning against the front of the house. They stared down at the porch as if watching the secrets of life unfolding beneath them, and nodded their heads slowly in unison, as if they were just real pleased about something.
See what I mean?
I didn't even answer.
This is pure bull.
Jack stared down through the trees toward the tracks.
There ain't a damn thing in or out of Hot Springs but a train load of sick people. What are we gonna do, steal a bucket of yellow spit?
I winked at Clell Miller and Charlie Pitts as Jack raised the blue bottle of morphine to his lips.
Feeling bad, Jack?
Got a tickling right here.
He tapped his chest. As the train rounded the turn a half mile back, I raised the shotgun from my saddle scabbard.
Here she comes, boys.
Jack stuffed the bottle into his shirt and raised his bandana around his face. Just then, I eased my black gelding forward right behind Jack's bay. At first, I just wanted to hit him hard enough to addle him. But as I drew back the shotgun like it was a club,
no!
Oh. Jack shot forward over his horse's neck and slapped the ground like a bundle of rags.
Good God, you've killed him.
He's all right. Let's get him in there and get it over with.
We deposited Quiet Jack Smith in the Spring of the Hill Sanitarium, the only place in Hot Springs at that time offering a restraining facility. He was still unconscious when they slipped him into what we called a happy jacket, and I cornered a thick-necked Swede orderly before we left.
I want my friend to be well taken care of.
I stuffed a roll of greenbacks into the feller's shirt pocket.
If anything happens to him, I'll reach back in your pocket and rip your heart out. Understand?
The big Swede looked us over, not a bit put off by our hardware, and smiled as cool as springhouse butter. Evidently, he'd dealt with our type before. I didn't know it just then, but as we dragged Jack into that sanitarium, Frank, Jesse, and Zerelda were on their way to a relative's farm in Adairville, Kentucky, so that Jesse could be looked over in much the same manner. I reckon using morphine laudanum must have been like letting a pet bear scratch your balls. It felt good, but you just never knew when it might get a hold on you. It's not widely known, nor was it ever talked about much in our circle, but on the way to Adairville, Cousin Jesse went into a dark frame of mind and tried to commit suicide. He got in his hand on 16 grains of morphine and downed a lethal dose before anybody knew it. Had it not been for Frank, Z, and an old backwoods physician, Jesse would have gone off dancing with the angels that night. Resting and drying out for 6 weeks in that peaceful community did Jesse a lot of good. The next time I saw him, he was as clear-eyed as ever and as game as a fighting cock. During the 6 weeks Jack spent in the sanitarium, I stayed around the outskirts of Hot Springs. Clell Miller and cockeyed Charlie Pitts turned surly and restless after the first week and left the very second I convinced them I would have no trouble staying away from the local authorities. To tell the truth, I feared one of them would end up killing somebody if they stayed pinned in one spot too long. Besides, with them gone, it gave me an opportunity to venture out a little and see if I would be noticed. I didn't want to spend my life hiding behind somebody's coattails. Jack and I had plenty of money buried near the Samuel place, and eventually, I wanted to track off on my own and settle down somewhere. With Clell and Charlie gone, I wired Dave Mather and had him put out word that Miller Crow had been seen all the way up in Colorado. After a few days, I ventured into Hot Springs real cautious-like and took a room at the Scherer House, less than a mile from where Jack lay sweating out his morphine. I spent the whole day barbering down and soaking in hot mineral water, then bought a brand new black linen suit, white shirt, and a bowler hat. During the remaining weeks, while Jack sweated it out in the Spring of the Hill Sanitarium, I quietly introduced myself as Jim Beatty and went about squeezing every dollar I could from the gambling crowd. Most of that bunch were either sick people looking for treatment from the mineral springs, or else they were visiting and attending such sick kinfolks. Either way, they had more on their minds than making money. It took me about 5 minutes to see that they were mostly just rich, bored, and worried, and gambling to pass time. Since I'd been holed up so long, I reveled in the action and raked in the cash. Careful to draw no undue attention to myself, I managed to stay 40% ahead in winnings and blended into the crowd like a homesick chameleon. From time to time, I rode out to visit Jack, mostly to make sure he was getting over any ill feelings he had about me cracking his head and making him go through treatment. On one of my earlier visits, I was busting to tell about my good fortune from the night before. I was so far ahead in winnings, I didn't bother counting anymore. I just made sure I lost every third or fourth hand. Jack, you ain't gonna believe what a pile of money I've scraped off this bunch. When they get out of here,
I ain't sat on the bed pod in over a week.
Jack's expression was a total blank. He sat with his hands folded calmly on the tabletop, wearing a white wool shirt buttoned at the throat. I just stared at him a second, not knowing what he expected me to say.
It's the truth. If I don't relieve myself soon, I'll go bug-eyed.
Well, Jack, I don't know what to say. I mean, I'm sorry, I reckon.
They say I've drank so much Blue River my insides don't know what to do or when to do it.
Jack, maybe I ought to go get the attendant or something.
Yeah, they're all crazy here, you know. Yeah, this whole damn bunch is crazy. If you don't get me out of here, I'll be goosing butterflies with a broom handle the rest of my life.
Jack, you gotta give it a chance.
Overnight, they shrink up about half their size and run up and down the hall slapping at rats with their underwear.
That did it for me. I eased backwards out the door and went straight to the head man. He was an old feller, bald as a stump, with a white beard that swung nearly down to his navel and spectacles that perched right at the tip of a thin hooked nose.
Mr. Beatty, I understand your concern for your friend. Believe me, what you're seeing are the results of a lot of powerful medication over a long period of time. He will get better, I assure you.
If my friend comes out of here babbling like an idiot, I'll spray this place down with a 10-gauge. You first.
What do you know about Mr. Smith?
What do you mean?
I mean, Mr. Beatty, what does your friend do? How does he act? Does he have blackout spells?
He works for me, if that's what you mean. As far as how he acts just fine. And no, I don't reckon I've ever seen him black out, unless you count being drunk. Why do you ask?
The old doctor reached into his desk and pulled out a stack of drawings. Spreading the stack across his desk, he placed his finger on one, motioning me closer.
These are drawings of Mr. Smith's skull. Notice these protrusions of bone, both here and here.
I leaned in and studied what was supposed to be the exact likeness of Jack's knotted head.
This indicates an old fracture that runs from just above the temple area all the way back to here, just above his ear.
How old a fracture are we talking about?
Very, very old. In fact, I would say these fractures, and I mean more than one, must have happened when he was no more than 8, maybe 10 years old.
So you're saying he must have been kicked more than once by the same horse?
Hardly, Mr. Beatty. Have you ever seen Mr. Smith without a shirt on? Ever seen his back?
Come to think of it, no, I reckon I haven't.
I'm afraid Mr. Smith has had a hard life.
Hell, ain't we all?
Broken ribs. Not just once or twice, but many times, judging from the bone structure. Scars. Welts so brutal that the swelling hardened into cysts.
Jesus, who would do something like that to a little youngin'?
That's why I asked what you knew about him. Apparently someone, a guardian, perhaps a parent, a friend, whoever they were, beat that poor man like an animal before he was even old enough to know why.
I backed 2 steps from his desk and lowered myself into a wooden chair. The old doctor removed the drawings from his desk, dropping them into a drawer.
That's also why I asked what he does and how he acts. Usually a person like that is, well, sometimes they're not very bright.
Hold on now. There ain't a damn thing wrong with Jack. Hell, he ain't what you call fancy smart.
Whoa.
The doctor nodded his head as if he'd seen the realization come upon me.
I'm not saying that your friend is an imbecile. In fact, there are some things he probably does that border on brilliant. But from time to time, his mind just gets away from him, kind of like a train jumping track.
Well, I reckon that's Jack. I reckon you called him about right. What'll become of him?
Now, that depends on you, Mr. Beatty. Your friend, people like him, have to have someone to follow, to mimic. Someone to inform them as to the wins and wears in life. So, I suppose what happens to Mr. Smith depends on you. You and the others.
What do you mean, me and the others?
I've been around a long time, Mr. Beatty. I know a couple of the boys when I see them.
Casually, I raised my hand, rubbed my chin, then let my hand rest against my chest. Under my shirt hung the .44.
The boys?
You have nothing to fear from me. Anything you say to me is in total confidence. Just consider it part of the treatment.
I ain't here for any treatment. And my mind is sharp as a Glades knife.
Of course. So let me tell you about your friend, or people like him. Your friend will recover from the morphine. He may go back to it. He may not. Like others carrying terrible scars or terrible memories, when he starts hurting, he'll reach for something. If not the morphine, Blue River, as he calls it, then something else. Like others, he'll more than likely drift from one thing to another. Liquor, low women, or like many of the boys, far-handedness, robbing and killing, anything to keep him on the move, anything to keep him from facing the pain.
I broke away from his gaze and stared down at the floor, but only for a second. When I looked back up, his gaze hadn't wavered an inch.
Tell me, Mr. Beatty, do you drink?
No, Doc. Well, that is, not enough to... Wait a minute. There ain't a thing wrong with me. I got no problems. At least nothing that pouring a little mineral water over is gonna help. You can save all that for your paying customers. I don't need it.
I understand.
You don't understand a damn thing. Not about me. You think I don't see that when you say that about Jack, all you're doing is talking about me, except you're doing it from around the corner?
I stood up and reached for the door. Something told me I didn't have to fear his saying anything about me or Jack. If I thought he would, I reckon I would have dropped him right there. What he'd said had hit me too close to home. I was angry, rattled, and somehow curious at the same time. I was stuck somewhere between shooting the bastard or dropping back down in the chair and asking him to tell me more. When I slung open the door to leave, I stopped for a second. There was something I wanted to tell that son of a bitch, but I wasn't sure what it was. In the back of my mind, I heard my pa yell as the rifles tore him apart, smelled old Cletus burn off the bone and sizzle in the fire, watched life snap shut in Kenny Elworth's eyes, and pictured a tiny stone somewhere in a Kansas City cemetery where a baby slept forever. I wanted to tell him all this. I wanted to twist my fists into his collar and shout it in his face, but when I spun around and faced him, I couldn't say a damn word. He had to see the madness flare across my eyes. He unfolded his hands and lay them flat on his desk.
I understand.
That night, I was gut-restless and testy as a galled dog. After losing a few hands in a row, hell, I couldn't keep my mind on the game. I drifted back to the Schreier house and slipped quietly into the nearly deserted bar. Alone in the shadows at a corner table, I studied the low flame of a lamp as it flickered soft gold through a bottle of rye whiskey. A picture of Jack Smith kept coming to my mind. This was not quiet Jack Smith, the outlaw, but young Jack Smith, a scared little boy hiding in a dark room of a large house, shivering in pain and fear. The picture flashed over and over. I couldn't drink it away. I was a little pissed at the doctor for telling me. Somehow, it didn't seem right for me to know all that about Jack. I remembered one night back during the war while we were holed up in the dark woods near the Valley of the Ozarks. Just to make conversation, I'd asked Jack about his folks.
Got none. My mama left when I was a baby.
What about your pa?
My what? What's that? My dad. Dear old father. He died when I was 14.
That's too bad. What happened to him?
He was killed. Killed in his sleep.
They ever catch the person who killed him?
I don't know. I ran away that night and never went back.
I was actually glad the night a skinny feller showed up with the message that Jack would be released the next morning.
A wagon load of water?
I tossed my hands in the air. Jack sat holding the reins with his arms crossed, staring straight out past the team of mules. His jaw was set and his mind was made up. I'd argued with him over half an hour, but he wouldn't budge.
I ain't leaving without it, so there.
This tears it, Jack. This just plumb damn tears it.
I leaned against the wagon with one hand and stared at the three barrels of mineral water.
Don't you think if this stuff really cured anything, they'd be selling it in every store in the country?
It cured me of Blue River. It cured the back of my head where somebody pothooked me with a shotgun barrel.
I climbed up beside him and settled into the hard wooden seat. I noticed a pillow sticking out from under his rump as he slapped the reins.
We sort of thought of bringing you one of these, but I reckon I need it worse after being pothooked and fitted to a happy jacket and all.
When we were 4 days out of Hot Springs, I stopped for provisions in a supply town called Pearly Point.
Jack, look out!
A small figure in a large, dirty coat came rolling down from the boardwalk. Whoa. Bounced off Jack and landed at my feet. I jumped back as tiny fingers appeared from the coat sleeve and snatched the Glades knife from my boot. The figure rolled away in a flurry of dust as I snatched the back of the coat and slung whoever it was against the side of our wagon. The Glades knife whistled past my face as I jumped back again. I grabbed a thin wrist as the big knife came back at me.
It's a little yellow woman about to wash your face with your own knife.
This ain't funny, dammit!
Hold that little bitch right there.
With my free hand, I reached into the coat collar and grabbed a handful of black hair and shoved back against the wagon. When I saw it was like Jack said, a little yellow woman, I eased up some and twisted the Glades knife from her hand. Then slung her away from the wagon and she fell to the dirt. I saw her face long enough to know she'd been smacked around pretty badly before she made it out of the saloon. In spite of the blood on her cheek and her swollen eye, I could see she was young, late teens, early 20s. She scrambled away in the dust, trying to get to her feet, but the big fella from the bar ran up and crashed a boot into her ribs.
You yeller whore!
He picked her up and slung her over his shoulder like a sack of feed.
Now we'll see which way it runs.
He started back toward the saloon.
Jack shot me a curious glance as the big fella walked past me. As much out of curiosity as anything else, I stepped in front of him, and he jerked to a halt. The girl's legs hung down from his shoulders. I reckon that kick in the ribs had crushed most of her strength.
What the hell do you want?
I glanced at Jack. Jack just rolled his eyes like he knew what was coming next.
What are you fixing to do to that little woman?
We're fixing to have some of her. What the hell's it to you?
I glanced around to the saloon and saw four or five faces peering across the swinging doors.
Jack had leaned his elbows on the hitching post as if to enjoy the show. I turned back to the big feller.
Aw, the hell with you.
He knocked me flat on my ass on the dirt street as he stepped up to the boardwalk and disappeared into the saloon.
Well?
Jack nodded toward the saloon. I knew what he was getting at. I pointed my finger straight at him.
No, by God, and I mean no.
I stood up, slapping dust from the seat of my pants.
I can't afford no trouble, and you know it.
I understand.
That was none of my business, and I shouldn't have butted in.
I understand.
Jack, I mean it. Whatever they do, it's their business.
He's one big son of a bitch, that's for sure. He ain't that big, and I ain't that little.
Let's get out of here.
Still, him knocking you down and all, seems like you ought to cut him just a little. Just for the sake of good manners.
I gritted my teeth at the sound, stared at the swinging doors, and wiped the blade across my pants leg. Stepping onto the boardwalk, I hesitated a second and glanced back at Jack. He smiled and slipped the safety strap from his .44. When I stepped through the swinging doors, Jack eased in behind me and faded off to the side. Inside the tavern, the big feller had ripped away her clothes and thrown her up on the bar. Three other men joined him, gathering like wolves over a wounded dove. She reached up and scratched at the big feller's bearded face, but missed. Instinctively, I felt my hand ready to rip open my shirt and grab my gun, but I calmed myself and walked up to them slow and easy. My Glades knife hanging from my hand, my heart beating to the slow, steady, familiar rhythm of a funeral drum. The bartender was the first to see what was about to happen. He sprinted around the bar.
Hey now, these are my customers.
He stopped as Jack raised his hand.
Your business is about to take a plunge.
Jack smiled. By the time the customers heard the bartender, I was within 6 feet of them, and the bartender was slipping out the door. They turned facing me like rats from a warm corpse.
Hell you want now?
Turn her loose or I'll kill you.
He glanced at the other three, then at me. He curled his lips back like a dog, revealing ragged brown teeth spaced like crooked fence posts.
Outta here, you son of a bitch.
The next thing I knew, I was halfway across the room, once again on my ass.
Lord God, what a lick.
Jack reached down, raised me up on my feet. I shook my head and staggered. The room swam before my eyes. At the bar, they turned back as if I'd never been there.
You reckon you'll ever get his attention long enough to cut him a little?
This time I will.
I was across the floor and swept over his back like a dark spirit. I yanked his head back and slammed down a vicious stroke through his tendons and windpipe. I let go and he fell to the floor.
So there you have it, boys. Your friend lost his head over a little piece of tail.
The others were tensed and ready. Jack wanted them to go for their guns. It had gone too far to stop, even if they wanted it stopped.
Do it.
With everyone out of the way, Jack walked through the blood, glancing around the room. I threw a dirty white tablecloth around the Chinese girl, raised her gently in my arms, and followed Jack out into the street. A crowd stared at the blood on me, the girl, the tablecloth, and Jack Smith as we climbed aboard the wagon, scanning the street in every direction.
Nothing to worry about. Few shots went off accidentally.
As Jack slapped the team's reins, the bartender and two men wearing badges elbowed through the crowd and ran into the saloon. Halfway down the street, I saw the bartender and the lawman run back out into the street. The bartender pointed at our wagon as they grew smaller in the distance. The lawmen stood there shaking their heads and staring after us. I sat crouched in the back of the wagon against a barrel of Jack's curing water, cradling the Chinese girl in my arms. In my bloody right hand, I still held the Glades knife. It drew tighter and tighter in my hand as the blood dried.
I stayed riled up at Jack the rest of the trip back to the Samuel place. By the third day, Little China had healed up enough to handle the team. I never saw anybody snap back that quickly from a hard beating. After the swelling went down and she cleaned herself up at a river crossing, I can't deny, tiny though she was, that she was as pretty as a new peach blossom. I reckon if there was any consolation for my black and bloodshot eye, it was the unending gratitude Little China would feel for me the rest of her life. I ought not to admit it, but I had not been with a woman since Janine. I'd had the urge many times, but somehow it felt as if I would be doing her wrong, even though I knew I'd never see her again. I reckon if a man truly had a calling to his own mind and spirit, mine would forever be ruled by sadness and the strength of my memories of my precious Janine. After hauling that curing water all the way from Arkansas, when we pulled into the Samuel place, Jack just walked away from the wagon and never looked back. Little China never fit in with the rest of the women folk. Though Z, Ma Samuel, and Frank's wife Anna went all out to make her feel welcome, it was a difference that would never be overcome. For that reason, I took a small piece of land 30 miles from the Samuels, fixed up an old cabin back in the woods, and settled us in. For 7 years, we lived there quietly. Little China full-time, myself between jobs and roaming the country to find good breeding stock. The Samuel place remained our meeting point over the years, but for security's sake, Frank and Anna took a spread down near Clear Creek, Tennessee. Jesse and Z stayed on the move, and Jack wandered back and forth between the Crazy Widow's place and God knows where else. When I got word that Frank Reno and his bunch were captured and lynched, I figured it wouldn't be long before the law started putting some pieces together. At the same time, I was greatly concerned about the way the law brought down the Reno gang. As stupid as that bunch was, I wasn't surprised when they fell. In fact, I'd predicted it would happen most any time, but I was startled to learn that the law had managed to sneak a couple of Pinkerton detectives into the gang. That's what got them killed. It worried me. It worried us all. Gathered that night in a ramshackle old barn, we stared back and forth among ourselves, our faces shadowed by our upturned coat collars and long oval hats. In the dim glow of the trimmed lanterns, we looked like ghouls from a lawman's worst nightmare. Dim light flickered on brass-trimmed revolvers and polished rifle stocks.
I ain't changing a damn thing. We ain't got a man with us tonight that ain't been with us from the start.
Cole Younger stood up and turned slowly, facing every one of us, one at a time.
As long as we don't let anybody else in or any of us out, we ain't got any reason to worry.
I agree with Cole.
Frank stepped into the lamplight. I hadn't seen him or Jesse in nearly a year. When he pushed back his hat, I was surprised at the strain in his eyes.
But a lot of things are different now. Before, when we lived together on horseback, we all moved as one, thought as one, and acted as one. All we had to protect was one another's backs. Now there's families, wives, and children to protect. And now the law is acting different. If they catch one, they offer him a pardon and cash money to turn in the rest. There ain't a man here tonight that I wouldn't ride through hell with. But think about what I'm saying. If you're sitting in a jail and a noose is swinging outside the window and it only takes a mouthful of names and places to send you home to your family, what will you do?
As our eyes met for a second, you must have seen what I was thinking.
That's right. I'm tired. I'm too damn tired. And from now on, nobody knows a thing about the next job till we're ready to do it.
Frank. If the Jameses are too tired to run this bunch, it's time Jesse steps down and turns it over to Cole.
Jim Younger threw up his hands in protest.
Where the hell's Jesse anyway?
He's up north. He's right now scouting a big job. Maybe the biggest we've ever done.
Where?
That's all I'm saying till we're ready to ride on it.
How far north?
All I'll tell you is that it's far north, up in Minnesota.
That night, when the rest of the boys split up, Frank, Jack, and I took lodging at a crossroads inn near Bardstown, Kentucky, before striking out back to Missouri. At a table against a wall in the rear of the bar room, we pulled cork from a bottle of Kentucky bourbon and watched rain run down a window. Frank's mood was low and quiet. At first, he just rolled a full glass of bourbon back and forth between his hands as if conjuring up a dark spirit. When Jack drifted off and worked up a game across the bar with a bored bartender, Frank finally tossed back the full glass and emptied it in one swallow.
I leaned on my elbows and studied the flame of a candle as it struggled against the shadows.
Want to tell me what's wrong, Frank?
I fear my brother is losing his mind.
Frank stared at me as he poured another glass.
Sometimes he just sits and stares. And more than once, I've overheard him talking to the dead, to people he killed. He argues with them mostly. Sometimes he cusses them. Z told me less than a month ago, she found him hiding in a corner of the barn, crying, praying, begging them dead men to forgive him.
Jesus, that's bad.
It's frightening as hell, cousin. I fear it'll soon drive him crazy. I wouldn't say it to nobody but you. But you've known all along, I'm the one who makes the plans and sets things up. Yet the fact is, it's Jesse's strength and force that keeps me going. Without his force of will, I fear I'll spill open and get us all killed.
Hold on, Frank. This ain't you I hear talking. You've been on the breach of damn sight longer.
Cousin, this is no bad man, desperado malarkey we're talking here. This is guts to guts. If you can't stand hearing it, let's change the subject and talk about the weather.
I stared at him, not knowing what to say. I'd never seen Frank this way. He was always the one with a tight and steady fist around the world. I reckon it shook me seeing his hand lying open. His eyes dilated, shiny and blank from the rush of alcohol. He stared at me with the look of an animal caught in a steel trap. For the first time since I'd met him, I couldn't understand the meaning of his message.
You know, Frank, what you told us in the barn tonight, that you'd ride through hell with us? There wasn't a man there who wouldn't do the same for you.
He just stared, unmoved, his feelings indiscernible.
I mean it, Frank. We all follow Jesse, but there's not a one of us who doesn't hold you in the same regard.
You haven't heard a word, cousin. Not a word. I'm trying to tell you the sky is falling. I'm not trying to gain your sympathy or your support. I know you would ride through hell for Jesse or me, either one. Maybe that's what sickens me.
Come on, Frank. You're just in a dark mood tonight. Tomorrow you're going to wonder why you said it.
Dark mood? We've run wild and reckless, and the devil will collect his dues. Yes, tomorrow, I might regret saying it, but I mean what I'm saying tonight. I have to live with knowing I dragged my kid brother into this hell. Jesse was just one more Missouri plow jockey when I rode back from the Southern forces. Now look at him. I'm the one who got him started, and I realize that every time I hear him cursing the dead.
Frank, Jesse was his own man. He could have chose different.
Listen to you. You're a fine one to talk. What were you doing when we brought you along? Tell me we didn't tempt you into our fold. Tell me how much choice you had. Blood and killing has a powerful pull on a young man. Tell me you didn't catch the fever for it. Now there's a gun to all our heads. We'll all die, tasting blood.
It was a long time after our meeting in Kentucky before Jesse set up the big robbery in Minnesota. It seemed like every time we got ready, something came up that made us postpone the job. Aside from the circumstances, I always breathed a little easier each time we put it off. After the strange talk I'd had with Frank that night near Bardstown, I sensed an air of doom about us. And at times, depression cut deep into my spirit. The first postponement came when Cole Younger got the living hell cut out of him down in Texas by Belle Starr's old man, Blue Duck. Cole had been sweet on Belle ever since she was 16, back when her name was still Belle Shirley. When she started whoring, Cole went a little crazy. He beat her up and tried to kill her. Later on, when she married Blue Duck, Cole went to Texas to draw blood on that crazy Indian, but came back looking like an Arkansas roadman. In Cole's own words, Duck cut him three ways: wide, deep, and frequently. By the time Cole was back to his spiteful, arrogant self and ready to ride, a terrible tragedy struck the Jameses. Struck all of us, for that matter. A band of detectives threw a bomb through Ma Samuel's window. The explosion ripped her arm off past the elbow and killed poor, simple-minded Archie Samuel, Jesse's and Frank's younger stepbrother. Every one of us went killing crazy. What kind of lawman would do such a thing? When someone hurt and killed your own, you drew vengeance. You killed swiftly and mercilessly, with no regard for retribution, even from the fires of hell. Two old fellers were still patting Archie's grave with their shovels when Quiet Jack and I rode past the cemetery. They stopped and watched as Clell and Ed Miller fell in beside us, still wearing their funeral clothes, but with bandoliers draped over their shoulders and shotguns propped straight up from their saddles. Up ahead, Frank and Jesse sat on their mounts in the middle of the road facing us.
Off on the side of the road, Cole Younger leaned against his horse, puking whiskey, blood, and yellow pus. He wiped his mouth on a handkerchief and swung up in the saddle. Stopping 10 feet from Frank and Jesse, I stared at Frank before they turned toward town. The old gleam of fire was back in his eyes. Before I could say a word, Frank raised his rifle from across his lap and propped the barrel straight up against his shoulder. He spun his gray stallion with a quick hook of the spur. It was near dark when we rode straight up the middle of the street, bold as brass and aching to kill. Lanterns turned hastily black in windows as we rode past. Behind us lay a wake of silence save for the sound of our horses' hooves. In the twilight ahead, three badges appeared briefly in the middle of the street, then disappeared as we rode forward. Two rifles lay abandoned in the dirt as we rode past that spot and to the front door of the hotel. Just as we spread out in a line across the front of the hotel, three well-dressed fellers came around the corner of the alley laughing, carrying a shiny flask of liquor. They were nearly to the door before they even noticed us in the evening gloom. They stopped cold. They looked at us with the look of men who had come to a great revelation. Their jaws went slack. One of them glanced between me and Jesse as if he was seeing double.
That's how they do it. There's more than one of him.
You've been looking for us. Here we are.
It wasn't a bomb. It was only a smoker. I swear to God, it wasn't a real bomb.
And these ain't real bullets.
Killing the detectives added fuel to the already heated war between the Jameses and the Pinkerton Detective Agency. Knowing what I knew about Jesse after the conversation with Frank back in Kentucky, I tried to lay low and keep to the shadows. If Frank was now shouldering the whole load and Jesse was growing unstable, I feared it only a matter of time before the law found a way to get to us. Without mentioning it to anybody, not even Quiet Jack or Little China, I sought out a spread of land in Kentucky, purchased it under the name of James Beatty, and began shipping some of my quality stock there a little at a time. Though I had money enough to pay cash for my land purchase, for appearance's sake, I paid half in cash and put the balance on a mortgage note with a bank we had robbed less than 2 years back. Unlike Jack and most of the boys, I held tight rein on my money, stashed it here and there, and kept my mouth shut about it. While the rest of our bunch pissed away money on whores and whiskey, I always kept an eye out for good horse flesh. Through a contact of mysterious Dave Mather, I managed to set up some paperwork and bloodline on Jeannie's Pride and renamed her Star Angel. I hated doing it, but with me being a wanted man, even my horse needed an alias. I hired two local brothers to oversee my Kentucky land and tend arrangements for the reconstruction of the old mansion on the property that had been nearly destroyed during the war. They were good folks, Jules and Herschel Parks, and they took care of my investment in Kentucky as if it was their own. As far as anybody knew, I was a land surveyor. I traveled a lot. To look the part, I grew a full beard and let my hair grow past my shoulders, like a true frontiersman. What time I wasn't off surveying, I dealt and raised horses. This was in case I ran into anybody while I traveled the racing circuit. It worked fine. When the time came, as I feared more and more it would, I would grab up Little China, Jack too if he needed a place to go, and we would blow out of Missouri like a bad wind. By the time we got ready for the big job in Minnesota, I'd moved all my top horses over to Kentucky. Jeannie's Pride, aka Star Angel, was heavy with a third colt. I'd bred her to a big fancy stud out of Atlanta, and I was anxious to see what would come of it. Her second colt, a filly that looked dead like her, was rain-breaking well. I expected to run her in another year. The first colt, the black stallion out of Cronin Wilcox's Star of Dawn, turned out to be a crazy son of a bitch. But I loved him like a father loves an only son. He was a fine and majestic animal, black as a bucket of midnight, with Star of Dawn strength and Jeannie's Pride, speed, and courage. He could outrun any horse I ever owned, including his mama, but the big ornery young stallion loved to fight and hated to race. So, what could I do? As soon as he was old enough, I held him at stud. The rest of the time, he was my personal riding stallion. I called him Buck, and all he would ever be any good for was to fight, fornicate, and rob banks. I reckon he fitted right in with most of the boys. I'd finished shoeing Buck when Clell Miller showed up at my place one afternoon.
Frank's at the Samuel place. Says he wants to see you. Says it's important.
I slipped out of my leather apron and hung it next to my smithing bench. Something told me it would be a while before I used my tools again, So I dropped my nails and nail pouch into a wooden keg and rolled it under the bench. Clell looked around at my empty corral.
Your spread's looking a little sparse. You hurting for money?
Thanks, but I reckon I'll make out till Minnesota.
I know I'm damn ready for it.
I started to saddle Buck.
This is gonna be my last bank, you know.
I smiled and shook my head as I swung up on Buck.
Sure, mine too.
Clell ran his finger across his chest.
Cross my heart, this is my last.
A mile from the Samuel place, Cousin Frank just appeared beside us from out of the woods.
Over here!
We slipped into the woods quiet as ghosts. A quarter of a mile in, we came upon Jesse mounted on a big roan, shifting his eyes back and forth from one of us to the other.
How have you fared since I seen you last, cousin?
I reined up beside him and shook his hand.
Neither better nor worse than yourself?
Jesse nodded. Now that we'd showed up, he holstered his .44, swung the rifle from across his lap, and slid it into his saddle scabbard.
I hear you're a hell of a horseman.
Yes, sir. I dicker horses some. And I do deliver them at a price, of course.
Jesse slapped my hat from my head. I hadn't seen him or Frank much since the night we gunned down the detectives. I'd missed them. I hadn't realized how much. I slapped my thigh. Minnesota was on.
Yeah! It's about goddamn time. I got horse hocking jewelry and praying for my return.
The next morning, back at my place, I held Little China close to me and watched the sunlight climb slowly across the window ledge. I brushed my hand down her flowing hair until finally she stirred from sleep and looked up from my chest. She read something in my eyes that caused her to lean up and glance about the room. Near the door, quiet Jack Smith lay rolled up in a blanket, his saddle beneath his head. His rifle and saddlebags leaned against the wall within quick reach. She laid her head back on my chest.
It won't be for long. As soon as I get back...
I felt her hand brush across my beard. Her fingertips stopped on my lips, silencing me.
No say.
After breakfast, Jack and I rolled our bindles and saddled up for the trek north. At last night's meeting, it went without saying that Jack would be my backup with the horses. We would gather a string on our way up to Minnesota, one or two at a time in case anybody happened to notice us. Pinkertons were everywhere and growing bolder every day. And now that the Reno gang was feeding worms, the Midwest Security and Detection Agency had committed their forces to bringing down the James gang. It was big money on all our heads. In my case, I wasn't so much wanted as a member of the gang, but I was wanted by every lawman in the world for killing Scheckler back in Kansas City. Of course, over the years, the name Miller Crow had cooled off some. Still, I walked real softly, especially when I traveled outside of Missouri and Kentucky. The only one of our bunch that wasn't sporting a price on his head was Jack. And that fact puzzled me all my life. For some reason, Quiet Jack was an invisible man. I'd never seen anything like it. For all the killing, robbing, and far-handedness he'd pulled in his life, and I mean in the open, bold as brass, nobody could have picked him out of a flock of geese. He could have walked back in a bank 20 minutes after robbing it, and I believe he could have opened an account. 3 miles out that morning, I turned to Jack.
How's things going with the widow woman?
I'm starting to think that woman's just a little bit crazy.
No kidding? Why do you think it?
Well, a few weeks back, I woke up in the middle of the night feeling like the roof caved in on me. I looked up, and there she was, sitting on my chest, holding that butcher knife with both hands ready to jar down on me.
Lord God, Jack, why?
Well, that's what I asked her. And listen to this. That crazy bitch said I was doing her the same way her husband did her. Said I wasn't paying her no attention.
What the hell did you do?
What the hell could I do? I just went on back to sleep.